Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today surprised everyone by overcoming the prejudices people felt about her because of her race and her gender. Cecilia Rodriguez Aragon is the daughter of a Chilean father and a Filipina mother. She is an author, air show pilot, and the first Latina full professor in the College of Engineering at the University of Washington in Seattle. Cecilia Aragon has worked with Nobel Prize winners, taught astronauts to fly, and created musical simulations of the universe with rock stars. Her major awards for research and a stint at NASA designing software for Mars missions led President Obama to call Cecilia Aragon one of the top scientists and engineers in the country. I've invited her here today to tell us about her memoir, Flying Free, My Victory Over Fear to Become the First Latina Pilot on the U.S. Aerobatic Team. Cecilia Aragon, welcome.
Thank you so much, Nancy. I'm very excited to be here with you.
Well, you know, your book is a memoir, but I sometimes, when I was reading it, I thought, you know, this could be in the self-help books, a section of the bookstore, because so much of what you have to say is along those lines. Do you find that the case?
Yes. Thanks for bringing that up. I mean, when I was first deciding how to tell my story, I wondered whether it should be self-help or pure memoir. And I finally decided that it was more effective as a personal story because people saw themselves in my book, even though they said, well, I've never flown and never wanted to fly, but so much of what you said resonated with me that I felt that that was a more powerful way to communicate the message. And hopefully it will have the impact of a self-help book while being much more personal.
Yeah, that I was surprised too at how I felt it resonated with me. And I also found that your book was a nail biter, Cecilia. And I wasn't so much aware of it because it's something you do unconsciously. I'd put my nails in my mouth and start chewing. But a friend who was watching me read your book would point that out. I said, oh gosh, but this is such a tense part of her book. It was so many points were real cliffhangers. And I thought, gosh, how is she going to get out of this mess she's gotten herself into?
I've loved stories and suspense ever since I was a child, and so I wanted to tell that story in that way that it would draw people in and hopefully be a lot of fun, because as humans we all love stories, and in many ways we learn better from stories than we do from sitting in a classroom and getting facts recited to us.
Yeah, but you know, I don't think of mathematicians. They're not the first ones to pop into my mind when I think of storyteller, I have to admit. So that's just another one of your varied skills and talents. Even if you didn't ride a bicycle until you were age 11, Cece, which you said that fact, your classmates laughed at you because you didn't ride a bicycle until age 11. So when you were in school, you were a kid, you were bullied. Where were you? And tell us what happened why you were bullied, Cecilia.
Well, I'm a first-generation daughter of immigrants. My parents were adult immigrants that came to the United States. And I grew up in a small town in Indiana. And although many of the people there were really nice and wonderful and good friends, unfortunately, there were a few kids in my school who didn't like having somebody who was both smart and not white. I was very good in math and reading, even at a young age. And unfortunately, even some of my teachers, I think gave in to common prejudices and believed that somebody with the last name of Rodriguez would never have a large vocabulary and couldn't possibly be very intelligent. there's certainly a narrative that I think is emphasized even today by the press, that if you're Latina, that you have to come from, you know, grinding poverty. And that really fosters that belief, that stereotypical belief that there aren't that many Latinx who are successful, who are middle class, who are doing well. And part of what I wanted to do with my book is to present a counter narrative to that stereotypical view.
Well, I have to tell you that I went off to college in Indiana and I had a Southern accent and I didn't think too much about it, but I was substitute teaching in a school there and a kid made fun of me for having he recognized the fact that I had a Southern accent. And that's such a minor and fleeting. It wasn't like you were regularly bullied and physically attacked. But I had that sense of, well, good grief, I'm not that far. I'm not that far away. I can only imagine what you went through. Because and Hoosiers are really wonderful people. I really, in fact, so wonderful, I married one.
Yes.
But I felt a pang when I would read about how you were bullied as a kid.
Well, thank you for saying that.
Well, when you left Indiana, and you were pretty young. I mean, I was surprised how young you were when you finished high school. How old were you when you left Indiana?
Well, I left when I was 16. I was pretty eager to get away. I should say, too, I mean, I want to make it clear that I, as I say in the book, that I love Hoosiers as well. And I feel that a lot of my strength came from the being in a community of people that believes in self-reliance and you know, pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. So it's not, so I don't want to make it seem like that, like it's all negative. But it's certainly clear to me that bullying is a terrible thing that we as adults really need to do more to counteract. And bullying can happen to anybody who is different in any way. It doesn't have to be race or gender. It's just a bad side effect of putting a lot of kids of the same age with, you know, relatively little adult supervision and allowing them to gang up on someone who's different. And part of why I wrote the book is that I hope to add to the growing narrative that bullying is not just a commonplace event. It actually can really harm kids when they're growing up.
My guest is Cecilia Rodriguez Aragon, and she has written a book that is entitled Flying Free, My Victory Over Fear to Become the First Latina Pilot on the U.S. Aerobatic Team. And knowing the title of your book and the airplane on the cover, I was shocked to find out that you had a fear of elevators, Cecilia. Oh, my goodness.
I was such a fearful child, unbelievably fearful. I was afraid of heights. I was afraid of public speaking. My palms would sweat before I shook hands with anyone. And so if you asked anybody who knew me as a child, they would have said that I was the last person in the world they would have expected to learn to fly small airplanes, much less learn to fly them upside down and in loops and rolls.
Well, since we are talking about your flying, you get right into the story. I mean, you get into the fact that you decided to try flying an airplane. And how did you make that leap from somebody who was afraid of heights? What possessed you, Cecilia, to get in an airplane?
Thanks for asking that question. I love answering this. So I really believe that these moments in your life where you enter terrified and leave exhilarated are meaningful, because terror and fear may not always be what you think it is. So before I even learned to fly, I was working as a software developer in Silicon Valley, and I was enjoying the work, but I was also leading this very narrow, safe, kind of nerd life. I wasn't taking any chances. Whenever anybody asked me to do anything, I was saying no. And then one of my coworkers invited me for a ride in his small plane. And my immediate thought was, oh, no way. I have a good chance of dying. So, and I'm not the sort of person who does this. And then it's almost as though I heard my dad's voice in my head, although my dad was totally against my flying. But I heard him saying that sometimes you need to not say no to everything. And I realized that because of my fear, I had allowed my life to become so narrow that my spirit was feeling suffocated. And so in that moment, talking to my friend, I knew I needed to face my fear just this once. So I said yes.
Well, you end chapter two with something that I found very true myself. This really resonated with what you said after that first flight. You say, I didn't die on that first flight. What I learned instead was that even if you take just a small step to face your fear, if you sign up for something you know is scary and you make yourself do it, the range of what you can do becomes wider. Over the months and the years, when you look back at how far you've come, you will realize how much you've grown and how much bigger the world has become. And I could think back of instances in my life when that was true for me. So I thought that was, in fact, I like the way you ended your chapters with these kind of inspirational lessons that you learned that you're passing on to those of us reading your book, Cecilia.
Thank you so much.
Well, you mentioned again, as you conclude chapter six, you say, when you face your fears and triumph over them, life opens up before you. Another technique that you used when you say you couldn't actually practice flying, you used visualization. How did you do that, Cecilia?
All right. So this first happened to me when I was had just gotten into aerobatics, and I ended up I got an ear infection and I couldn't fly for about 6 weeks. And I was devastated. I had just discovered aerobatics and I loved it more than anything else in the world, but I couldn't do it. So what I did is I got a videotape of Dwayne Cole, who's an old-time aerobatic pilot, a real pioneer. And he was going through maneuvers in his super decathlon. And I watched it and then I would close my eyes and pretend I was flying, and I would go through the feeling and I would imagine that I was doing each of these maneuvers just like I was in the airplane. All my senses were engaged. I could smell the airplane. I was breathing. I could feel the G-forces that made me heavier or lighter. And as I did that over and over again, I found myself learning how to fly. And when I got back in the airplane after my ears healed, I discovered that I'd actually improved significantly. And since then, I have read that this is actually very common, that there have been experiments done where they divided a group of kids into two groups, and they had one practice throwing basketball free throws, and the other group threw a couple of baskets and then just sat in a room and imagined themselves throwing the basketball. And what they found out was the kids who imagined themselves, who visualized themselves throwing that basketball, actually improved more and scored better than the other group.
In fact, some years ago, I read of a study they conducted, and the muscle they happened to have used was the quadriceps, and they had people visualize strengthening that muscle, just visualizing strengthening that muscle, and found that when they retested, the muscle was stronger.
Yes.
I even had, because I teach yoga, had a lady who was in an automobile accident. And as soon as she recovered enough to drive, she would come to class. There was very little she could actually do, but she said, I want to come to class and visualize myself doing what you're describing, what you're leading the other members of the class to do. And I didn't get a chance. I lost touch with her after a while, but I thought I admired the fact that she did that.
And I bet it was successful for her.
Yeah, as a part of her recovery from her automobile accident.
Yes, absolutely. I do yoga as well. And I have found that you do not have to push yourself or do a beautiful pose, just sitting in the beginning position of a pose and breathing is often very powerful. It's the connection between your mind and your body.
In fact, one thing I encourage students when they see a pose and they say, oh, I can't do that. And I remind them, just put the word yet in there. Just because you haven't done something yet doesn't mean you can't do it.
Absolutely.
After a break, I'll continue my conversation with Latina aerobatic pilot Cecilia Aragon. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Cecilia Aragon, professor of engineering at the University of Washington in Seattle. And your book is Flying Free, My Victory Over Fear to Become the First Latina Pilot on the U.S. Aerobatic Team. And at this time, you're living in the Bay Area. You're a computer programmer, and you label yourself, as we often do computer programmers, you already referred to yourself as a nerd, but you had four initials for yourself. Your label for yourself was, what do those INTF, what do those initials stand for, Cecilia?
Yes. So that was, so INTF, incompetent, nerd, terrified, failure. This is sort of my play on the personality types, the Myers-Briggs personality types. And I believe that I was not a very successful person, sadly.
Well, you know, often it's the parents that put these kind of labels on their kids, like that label, those words that you just use are not complimentary. And that was not the case for you. It was not your parents who were telling you, Cecilia, you're an incompetent and failure. They were not telling you that. What was your parents' reaction to you as you were growing up as a child?
I was really lucky. I had two parents who were extremely supportive. And my dad in particular always believed in me. He always said, you are brilliant in math. And this was not something I heard very often.
And not from your teachers either.
No. I had one junior high teacher who said, why are you working so hard in math? You should be getting a boyfriend.
Yes, I was disappointed in the teachers that you had who did not. In fact, they discouraged you.
They did, sadly. I mean, not all of them. I had some wonderful teachers. But sadly, many of them believed that, I mean, and it may have been partly because I was quiet. But also, I think a bigger problem was they saw my name, Cecilia Rodriguez, and I was quiet, and they assumed that I was just the stereotype of the daughter of immigrants. And that is the corrosive impact of systemic sexism and racism in this country. And this is something that I hope to talk about in the book, about how this is something that we can all overcome. And the fact that my father was that, he was that one voice of support that told me, those teachers are wrong. You are going to succeed at whatever you do. He never had any doubt that I would be a success. And that one voice was enough to give me the inner strength to counteract that chorus of voices. And this is partly why I became a teacher and a professor, because I want to be that one voice for students today, for anybody who has been discouraged, whether it's by their parents or by their classmates or by other teachers. I want to be that one voice that says, you can do whatever you want to do. You are spectacular. You are wonderful. And I think that's something that students often don't hear as much as they should. I mean, one of the things I really believe very strongly is that there are two aspects to teaching. One is that you push. I expect a lot of my students. I don't just support them and tell them they're great. I say, you're great, and I expect you to do this mathematical theorem. I expect you to write this software. I expect you to write this paper. And I push them, and they might say, well, I don't know if I'll be able to get it done. And I look at them, and I say, you can do it.
Well, and your father was in a position to be able to judge a good mathematician because his own background, what was his background?
So my dad was a theoretical physicist and a professor. And how he became a professor and how he studied physics when in his entire country, there was no physics training. And his parents didn't have enough money to send him abroad. That could be its own story, and someday I'll write it. But he overcame his own poverty and managed to come to the United States, where he studied at the University of California, Berkeley, which at the time was pretty much the only university that didn't have tuition. And he entered the physics program and graduated. His PhD won the best dissertation of the year from UC Berkeley in physics, which is one of the top departments in the world.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
When you think about that, the courage that it took to do that.
Yes.
To leave his native country and yes. pursue something that he was passionate about.
Yes. I think part of when people say I have courage, I think a lot of it came from both my parents. I mean, they left their home countries to go to another country where they didn't speak the language and they had never been in the culture, and they came alone and they succeeded.
Well, you know, you were saying that sometimes against all odds, you shouldn't be able to do something, and yet you were determined you were going to do it. And like I say, so much of your book resonated with me. I thought back to when I was a graduate student in the second semester. They called me over during registration. Apparently, they had more people signed up for this class. And usually, teaching assistants would teach just beginning classes. And they asked me, said, can you teach this? And it was a more advanced class. And inside my head, I was thinking, oh my gosh, how could I possibly do that? But I said, yes. Yes, because
yes.
I knew by hook or crook, I was going to figure out a way to do it.
Yes, that is absolutely the right attitude. That's the attitude I hope to teach everybody. I mean, so many of us give up and we say, I don't want to do something if I'm not qualified. I don't want to do something difficult. I want to take the safe choice, the easy choice, because I'm not suited for this sort of difficult thing. And yes, what you did is what you have to do. You have to do something that stretches you, that challenges you, because otherwise your life is going to become smaller and narrower and safer, and it will eventually suffocate you. A safe life can actually end up being more dangerous.
Well, and then the passion is there as a motivator, because I loved teaching. And if they were going to offer me an opportunity to challenge myself as a teacher, I was right jumping in with both feet. And that's what, as you discovered your passion for flying, you said, yeah, this is something I've never done. I'm fearful, but I have such a passion for flying that I'm going to do this. That's what came across to me in
yes.
your book, Cecilia.
Yes.
Remind listeners that my guest is Cecilia Aragon, and her book is Flying Free. And I love that word free in your title, because I think people put restrictions on themselves. They can't even conceive of how much they could free themselves. And your book is a story of that, of here's how you can do it. Here's how you can free yourself, whatever your circumstances are. Well, you take these lessons, and how did you go about signing up for lessons? Because you were a computer programmer. You had a full life. You had a husband that was in the beginning saying, Cecilia, what are you doing wanting to fly? And you, in fact, you didn't even tell your parents for a long time that you were doing this. So how did you manage to learn to fly when you had a full-time job?
Well, so I didn't start out by saying, oh, I'm going to be a member of the United States aerobatic team. I didn't have this huge, impossible goal.
Most of us, I wouldn't have even known that the U.S. had an aerobatic
right.
team.
I certainly did not. What I said is, I love flying so much, I want to figure out how to do it on my own. So what's the first step? Well, take flying lessons. That meant I had to pick up the phone and call someone. And that was scary for me because, talking to a stranger was very terrifying. But I said, okay, today I'm going to pick up this phone and I'm going to make a call. So, having a full-time job and learning to fly and having a family, it's always challenging to have many things in your life. But what I've realized is that I spent a lot of time sort of wasting time just agonizing over what I should do and what I shouldn't do. And if I just went out and did it, I wasted a lot less time. And it was expensive, and that was always a struggle, figuring out how to pay for this. But I cut back on other areas. I mean, like anybody who knows me will say, well, you sure don't spend much on fashion.
At the hairdresser, apparently, because people criticized your hair.
Yeah, my hair is, mixed race hair is always a problem. It kind of always looks like I didn't brush it that day. I would create a small, achievable goal each day, and I would do that. One small goal that maybe was a little difficult for me, like picking up the phone or going out to an airplane and doing something new, and I would do it.
Well, at one point in your book, this is after you've been successful in your aerobatic endeavor. You said, against all odds, an awkward woman who couldn't operate machinery was unexpectedly good at aerobatic flying. But why? Something about the precision and rhythmic work, well, with my brain.
Yes.
And you said, how did this happen? Didn't my driver's ed teacher sneer at my skills? Didn't I go through 3 instructors before I got my private pilot license? And you said, I'd finally learned to believe in myself. This was a question you said. Was that the magic I'd been missing all my life? And I think sometimes people miss the magic in their life because they let themselves be stymied by fear.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. And I really had this belief that I was a mechanical klutz. And that had been, it's just like I sometimes meet, girls today that say, oh, I'm not good at math. It's the same thing. We get these ideas in our head and they become enshrined.
Well, I have never felt I was any good at anything practical. I mean, you give me a book and I can open the page and I can turn the pages and read, but you say, okay, here's a toilet that needs fixing. And I thought, oh, I can't do that. And I was married 45 years to somebody who could do these things. He was a scholar, but he also had practical skills. And then when he died, now suddenly, oh, gosh, I should have been paying attention when he was fixing toilets or when he was doing something practical. So I had that same kind of feeling when I actually fixed it. I had help, of course, directing me. But when I fixed a toilet, I thought, wow,
yes,
what else could I be doing that I never thought I could do?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's, yeah, what you don't use, you lose, right? And we all have a tendency to depend on others, which is how we evolve. That's, it's okay to depend on others, but it's also so exciting and powerful to do something on your own. I mean, as you said, even something simple, it just makes you feel so good and so powerful and so strong that you can do anything.
And I noticed my changing is when I first was saying, oh no, I can't do this. I can't do this. And then it began to change. Even as I was working, I'd say, hey, you know what? This is actually kind of fun.
Yeah.
This is how toilets worked.
Yeah, right. And hey, you know what? I mean, you can say that being able to fix a toilet is kind of mundane, but boy, speaking as somebody who's had toilet failures, wow, what a mess. And isn't it great to be able to take care of that yourself?
And to gain that tiniest little bit of confidence.
Hey, yes.
I actually did that. We're going to take a short break and then continue our conversation about Cecilia Aragon's memoir, Flying Free. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest, Cecilia Aragon, has written a memoir, Flying Free, My Victory Over Fear to Become the First Latina Pilot on the U.S. Aerobatic Team. Now, I was interested in how you actually chose, you were Cecilia Rodriguez, you chose the name Aragon. And you and your husband both decided you were going to choose a surname, Aragon. That's pretty brave, Cecilia.
Yeah, it was brave. It was particularly brave for my husband, I think, because he was bucking more of the trend, the societal trend. But we both felt that we wanted to have an egalitarian marriage. We both realized that we wanted to start a new life together, and choosing a new name together that represented a little bit of his ancestors and a little bit of my ancestors was a wonderful way to start our life together.
Well, I mentioned in the beginning, your husband was somewhat of a skeptic, but you won him over. But now, so you were renting planes, because this is a very expensive hobby that you've undertaken.
Very expensive.
You're renting planes, and then people started telling you, you figured out yourself. Okay, here's the cost of renting a plane, and here's the cost if I buy my own plane. And what did you conclude?
So, despite all common sense, I discovered that it would actually be cheaper if I bought kind of a beat up old airplane that cost about $5,000 at the time, which was a lot of money for me. I did not have $5,000 sitting around, but I hadn't even bought a car at the time. But I realized that due to the costs of rental, that if I bought the airplane and if I flew it sufficiently, that the total costs would be less. And there was an extra benefit. I was still scared of flying. And every time I got into every time I was about to get into an airplane, I would try to think of excuses like, oh, maybe there is a mechanical problem. And so it's not safe to fly today. So what I realized is if I owned a plane, if I didn't fly it, it would be more expensive. So by owning a plane, that would force me to do more flying, which actually would make me a safer pilot, because it turns out that if you fly more frequently and practice, you gain more skills, kind of logical. So I bought this very simple, safe trainer airplane. And once I had bought it, most of the cost was in owning it and paying for insurance and all those fixed costs. And then just actually getting in the plane and flying around cost me a lot less than a rental.
Well, another way you made that commitment to yourself, yes, I'm going to fly regularly, was that you said, okay, I've got this expensive habit. I can't quit my job because I need the income from being a computer programmer, but yet I have this plane I want to fly. How can I do this? And so what idea did you present to your employer?
So I was so proud of myself for this.
Well, I was impressed. Yeah.
I convinced my boss. I'm still not quite sure how I did this, but I did a good job. I was a good programmer, despite what they all thought of me. when I first came in, they didn't expect much. Yeah, I was a woman and a Latina, but then I would wow them. And I would use that. I would say, you know, so what I said to this one boss is, I would like to come in from 9 to 1 in the morning, and then I'll have my meetings with everybody else. And then I want to take a really long lunch break from 1 to 5. And then I'll come back and work again from 5 till 9. So I'm getting my, you know, the full 8 hours a day. But what that did for me is during the day from 1 to 5, I was able to drive out to the airport and fly during the day.
And that was not a short drive. I mean, that took up a good bit of your time.
It was 45 minutes to get there. But the track, you know, less... It wasn't rush hour, right? If I had to stay at work and then drive afterwards, first of all, my plane didn't have any lights, so I couldn't fly it after sunset. But also, you know, the type of flying I was doing, I needed to do it during the day. So by shifting, but I can program at night. You can program anytime, right? So I suggested this, and my boss said, well, you know, that sounds a little strange, but you have done a good job. If you continue doing the good job you're doing now, I'll allow it. And it worked.
Well, in this same chapter, when you were coming up with this idea of how to rearrange your schedule, you described what happened when you were younger and your mother's reaction, because I had practically the same experience, only instead of my mother, it was my best friend who was giving me advice about playing ping pong with the boys. And she said, let the boys win. Don't beat the boys at ping pong. And what happened to you when you were playing this?
Okay, thank you for bringing up one of my favorite stories. And I'm glad this happened to you too. There were a group of kids that were always playing ping pong, and I was one of them. And there was this other boy who was about my age, and he and I were evenly matched. You know, we would play, and one of us would win, and the other would win, and it was really fun. I mean, it's fun to play with somebody that you really have to work to beat.
It is. I can vouch for that.
I mean, you know, I would play with the younger kids too, and you know, with them, I would be a little gentler, right? I would still win, of course, but I wouldn't smash them to the ground. But then this girl showed up, and she was terrible playing ping pong, but she was also our age. And I noticed that this boy started just playing ping pong with her, even though there was no challenge, because she played this really soft, easy game. And I was like, why is he wasting his time playing with her when I'm a more fun player? I mean, when we've been having so much fun together. And my mom said, Well, maybe it's because she lets him beat her and he likes that. And maybe you should do that too. And of course I said, never.
Yeah, your mother said, you should try it. Maybe it's because she lets him win. You should try it.
Yeah.
And you didn't.
I didn't. That's no.
My guest is Cecilia Rodriguez Aragon, and her book is Flying Free, My Victory Over Fear to Become the First Latina Pilot on the U.S. Aerobatic Team. So we have you at the point where you're flying, you've bought your own plane, but then your advice from others are you saw other planes, and what did you do about the fact that this plane was no longer serving your purposes?
Oh, yes. Okay. So I love these stories. Can I just take a step back? Because I wanted to say one more thing about ping pong and my mom.
Sure.
I want to say that my mom said that to me, but it was a case of do as I say, not as I do, because she loved to play ping pong and she was really good at it.
Now, you don't tell us this in the book.
I don't talk about it. There were so many things I left out of the book, sadly, but she was actually a champion and she beat all the guys. and when we would play, she would play really hard and we never beat her. I mean, I remember playing as hard as I could and I would never beat her. And she wouldn't, it's like, what do you let me win, Mom? She'd say, no. So I think I have some of, both my parents had this, you know, this spirit of I'm going to do it and I'm not going to let anyone tell me to give up. I'm really fortunate. I mean, that's a tremendous privilege to have two parents who are like that. And I recognize that not everybody has that. So,
well, I mentioned that this is an expensive hobby that you've taken up, but it becomes more than a hobby. You actually qualify to be an instructor, a flight instructor. So you get some income from being a flight instructor, your computer programming, but you still, it's very expensive. So you decide, they pay people to participate in air shows. So maybe that's something I'll try. And what did you do to become a star in the air show?
So the first thing I did, of course, like the best way to learn to become anything is to, you know, do research. I guess I'm a geek and an academic, so maybe that's why. So I took classes, I studied, I talked to other people, I did my best to learn what it's going to take to be a good airshow pilot. I wanted to be a safe airshow pilot and I wanted to be able to put on a show that was fun because I loved air shows myself. I loved watching other people do these really cool things. And so I thought, well, what can I do that's unique and different? And I realized that my precision flying, it was kind of like Olympic figure skating. I could fly these really powerful and precise maneuvers. And a lot of aerobatics and a lot of air shows were more gentle and, you know, and they, like they would have, and they had little gimmicks, you know, like a comedy act. And I said, well, I can't do a comedy act, except unintentionally, maybe. but I can do a dance in the air because that's what I do and that's what I love. And so I decided to set out to become a professional airshow pilot so I could earn some money and earn a living at this sport that I loved so dearly.
Well, I want to skip ahead to a guy named Paul who shared flying information with you. And at the conclusion of this chapter, you say, for the first time, I realized I could put my entire self, my fragile and tentative life in someone else's hand, and they might hold it gently and return it to me. And even more important, this was the way it was supposed to be. People were meant to share and hold one another, to lift a hand in support. I'd rarely known that growing up. And what a lovely thought, because this person had gave you this insight that people were meant to share and hold one another and to lift a hand in support.
Yes, this was maybe one of the most important things that flying gave to me, the flying community, the pilot community. It didn't matter anymore what my gender was or what my race was. People, so many people of so many different kinds and political persuasions, reached out to me because I was a pilot who loved flying. And I could keep you on the, you know, on this interview for hours, telling you stories of kindness, of pilots that reached out to a complete stranger and helped me when I needed help. This community showed me what it meant to be part of a human community, what it felt to be supported by the people around me, and in turn to give support back. And that was so wonderful and so healing to my soul, really, because I suddenly felt supported by other people. And this one particular story with Paul was where I was stuck because of bad weather and my airplane didn't have the kind of equipment I needed to fly in bad weather. And this other pilot offered to let me fly formation on him, to let me follow him through the bad weather, because he had better equipment than me that could handle it. And because of that, I was able to get to my destination and fly on the United States aerobatic team. And that just floored me, that it was so kind. And it was truly an amazing act of trust, because I have to say that by allowing me to fly formation on him, he was basically saying, I trust you with my life. Because if I messed up and crashed into his plane, we were only inches apart. If my skills weren't good enough, it could have, you know, he could have died. We could have both died. So that deep sense of trust was very powerful to me. And it also brought up how often this had happened to me in the aviation community. This is one of the wonderful things about being a pilot, is being around other pilots. I have to say that is a true joy of this sport.
Well, you even use the word birthright, and you say that this was the way it was meant to be. At last, I felt one with my world, my life, the inevitable extension of fundamental principles, my emotions and desires, the purest expression of the urgent drive upward. So this community that you described, you felt that was the way it was supposed to be. And now I would like to, if you would, Cecilia, I really like the way you conclude your book. And so can we skip to the very last page of your book?
Before I do that, could I just tell one last story?
Yes.
People often come to me and they say, you know, well, life is really unfair. And what can I do when I encounter something that's really unfair? And so the story I tell to answer that is when I was trying out for the U.S. aerobatic team the first time. And you know that children's story about the little engine that could?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I had this relatively inexpensive little airplane that couldn't. It was not on the same level as all the other planes. They had far more resources than I did. They had these expensive high-performance planes. And there I was at the contest, and when I saw the sequence we were assigned to fly, I realized that based on the laws of physics, my plane could not fly it. I needed one of these high-performance planes, and I was competing against them, and I did not get a handicap. So I remember going back to my hotel room and just despairing. I said, I'm just going to give up. This sport is not for me. It's physically impossible for me to compete with the plane that I have, and I've spent every last dime I have. I even took a second job to get this less expensive plane. But then I heard my dad's voice. And he would talk to me when I got stuck on a math proof. And I would always say, I can't do this. It's too hard. And he would say, there's always a way. Don't give up. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to think about it one more time. So I looked at the problem and then I said, well, okay, what do I have to do? I have to maximize my score. Well, wait a minute. That's a math problem. Math is something I can do. So I came up with an algorithm that allowed me to do workarounds for each of my plane's weaknesses and maximize my score. And then the next day, I went out and I used that algorithm. I flew the plane exactly the way I'd imagined it. And I got not a perfect score, but the best possible score I could get in my little airplane. And I made the team.
My guest is Cecilia Rodriguez Aragon, and her book is Flying Free, A Victory Over Fear to Become the First Latina Pilot on the U.S. Aerobatic Team. And it's very, I loved your story about when you were at Washington and you really felt, you know, flying over Washington, D.C., you really felt patriotism there. That inspired patriotism. And then, of course, you go to France, which is an adventure. And all along the way, you kept thinking, oh, my gosh, she's not going to make it. So maybe I shouldn't tell people whether you make it or not, because they'll be biting their nails like I was. But you do conclude in your book with a talk you were giving at a conference. This was in 2016. And just briefly, what inspiring words did you have for the women in that your audience?
So I used to define myself as unable to speak in public. And I think that there's a message that's been drummed into many of us that, you know, only the best survive. If you don't make it through your program, you must not be good enough. It couldn't possibly be, because it's a hostile environment for women or people of color. It couldn't possibly be because sexual harassment exists, or because there are subtle forces arrayed against anyone who's different. It couldn't possibly be because your environment or your cockpit wasn't designed for you.
Oh, that's a funny part too. Here you are, 5'2", 100 pounds, and this plane that you buy was made especially for a 300-pound guy. So all these details in your book about your flying experiences are just found riveting. I just really enjoyed reading that. And I know listeners will enjoy it on so many levels. So let me remind people again, the book is Flying Free, My Victory Over Fear to Become the First Latina Pilot on the U.S. Aerobatic Team. The author is Cecilia Rodriguez Aragon. Thank you, Cecilia.
Thank you. This was one of my favorite interviews.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.